It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Sunday, November the 30th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and you could join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Sign up for our chat for free. For less than the price of a cup of coffee a month, you could join and get some premium content and have a ton of fun while you're at it. Interact with me, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to a post-Thanksgiving holiday leftovers edition of the Talking Mets podcast. A lot to talk about, lots of gossip and rumors out there. It was a weekend that went from sleepy to pretty interactive for the Mets community, thanks to some rumor mongering over at the New York Post. Kodai Senga still wants to be a Met. Is Framber Valdez close to being a Met? Mailbag and more on this post-Thanksgiving leftovers holiday edition of the Talking Mets podcast. I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving. Maybe I'm the last thing that you're listening to or the first thing you're listening to after the weekend. So hope you get yourself in gear and get back at the work week and a big week ahead. What I thought was going to be a sleepy week heading into the Thanksgiving holiday with the MLB offices, you know, they're not really open. I think, like I've been saying, a lot of the league takes off on holidays now. It's not, it's a 24/7, 365 job, but it's normalized into somewhat of a decent work schedule where it needs to be during the holidays. But you had the news around this time a week ago, the Brandon Nimmo for Marcus Semien trade. Got a chance to hear from Nimmo, got a chance to hear from Semien, former Mets setup man. Really disappointing deadline deal. Ryan Helsley signed with the Orioles for a couple of years. So we got some of that news. News coming out that maybe the Mets are in and closing in on Framber Valdez. We'll see what that's all about. But first, before we get to any of that, let's talk about gossip. And let's talk about this whole clubhouse situation that seems to continue to be playing up. And it got a lot of traction. Mike Puma coming out with a report with basically another clubhouse incident between Francisco Lindor and Jeff McNeil. We all remember 4 years ago, the rat raccoon situation where I think the cameras caught it. Everybody was running down at the hallway. Maybe Lindor's first year with the team and McNeil got into it. McNeil, a fireball, you know, a guy that essentially has a lot of spit and dirt and vinegar. Reminds me a little bit of how some of those guys in the late 80s were at the Mets, the Backmans, the Tuffles, the Dykstras, guys like that. A bit of a throwback, a little bit of a temper. Maybe he's got a little bit of Greg Jeffries in him at that point. And Lindor is, up until Soto coming here, the highest paid player, a guy that fancies himself, who plays a premium position, the most recognizable, wealthiest player on the club, brought in to essentially be imported as the leader. And I think at times, it just seems like him and McNeil, with some of the behaviors on the field, whether it be McNeil's defense, what have you. I think both times, I'm trying to think back to the 2021 incident, I think that might have had to do with defense as well. Lindor is somebody that easily will call out McNeil and obviously takes his role as a vocal leader on the team seriously. Now, when we get to the mailbag later, I know some of you guys disagree, and we'll get into that. But I think we'll start out by the timing of the report. First off, this report that I think will become a big deal because it's going to continue to be, okay, the Mets clubhouse had issues. That's why they underachieved. That's why they were the 83-win team. And that, again, on June 12th, when this team had one of the best records in baseball, nobody was talking about that. And it wasn't like all of a sudden there was harmony up until June 12th, and there was disharmony after. That's not why Kodai Senga's hamstring blew out. That's not why the bullpen was overused. That's not why the starters were injured and ineffective. That's not why this team at times, the offense browned out and did not execute, not hit situationally, did not hit with runners in scoring position. It was a team that had deficiencies. It was a team that, and we've talked about it time and time and time again, maybe was a little bit top heavy and the strategy with the staff, particularly bringing in reclamation projects or guys who had stuff like a Frankie Montas and trying to turn them into the next Luis Severino 2024, the next Sean Manaea 2024. I mean, speaking of Sean Manaea, it wasn't the clubhouse that got him injured. It didn't work. So really what you have to remember with this gossip is that there's a business model when it comes to media. And the business model is to generate clicks. And when it comes to reporters, especially those on the beat, and I really feel this, and this is not a knock at the beat guys, because there's guys who come on the show. Andrew comes on the show. Will Salmon. We've had Mike Puma on the show who authored this article over at The Post. I think Andy Martino at SNY does good work. And he's probably one of the best in terms of being clued in and understanding the business of baseball. Really does. And they all do good work. And it's a tough job, and they don't get paid enough to fly around the country and cover baseball. It's a tough job. But I think the position of the beat, especially with how it's being filled as more tenured writers are moving on with their careers, and what they're really bringing in is lower cost, and I got into trouble in the past saying this, but lower cost, younger, essentially out of journalism school writers who, let's face it, are really kind of the stenographers at this point that are going out there and taking a pulse of what people are talking about and rehashing and reiterating it, and they're getting some quotes, and they're doing a fundamental job when it comes to how they report on the team, but they're not doing anything exciting. We're far from the days of Bob Clappish and John Harper, and when Heyman was, you know, covering the Yankees here. All these guys, Buster Olney, back in the 90s, Ken Rosenthal, what he became, Passan, and how he has become a locked-in insider. You have a few of the elite guys that wind up, usually through agents, becoming really insiders, becoming the cream of the crop, really respected because of their knowledge of the game, their experience covering the sport, their connections, a guy like Sherman and Heyman, regardless of whether you like their opinions or the way they go about it, these are guys that have covered the sport a long time, and through that experience, they have institutional knowledge, they have a way of understanding how the game works, they have a way of navigating to get information, and as time goes on, those guys are becoming a dinosaur. Because the new age group is not doing the same thing. And I think part of that is the league, and part of that is that the teams don't want it. The teams want to manage their information because no good comes out of leaking unless they're the ones doing the leaking that's in their benefit. A lot of times it creates more mismanaged expectations with the fan base. So what you have now is a beat that doesn't necessarily get leaks, doesn't get any kind of connections. Even if they tried to go that route, it probably wouldn't go anywhere. They're getting gobbled up by all the other avenues to consume the sport, namely what I do here, some of the insider stuff, the social media interactions, and all the different kind of posts that go around with analytics writing and people talking about things and fans playing GM. And let's face it, there's a lot of guys that, you know, they don't even have to be on the beat. And I'm just talking about Mets guys. When I see them write about the game, mainly educated speculation, somewhat basic information. I mean, I'm at a point, and this is not me bragging, because I get my information from really good people. I don't come up with everything. Yeah, I have tons of ideas, and I have my own opinions, and I try to formulate it, but I also want to do research. I'm getting it from somewhere. And a lot of times, I'm not necessarily consuming a lot of what the beat writers are putting out there. Now, The Athletic, whether you like it or not, they do some really good work over there. I think the New York Post is the cream of the crop when it comes to sports reporting. I think the Post Plus guys are pretty good. I think some of the other guys are good at aggregating information to not and I think the problem sometimes with fans is because if you're a writer for the Post or you cover the Mets, when you put information out there that's educated speculation, it's considered legitimate because you have that, whatever you want to call it, name or that company behind you. And really at that point, I could do the same thing on Talking Mets podcast, but I don't have the New York Post behind me, so it's looked at a lot differently. So how does the business of media then get away from the scrum? Because now they're in the scrum. And remember one thing, and you'll hear a lot of the longtime radio hosts talk about it. The Michael Kays have said it a lot. Frank Isola says it a lot on his NBA show. Well, everybody's got a podcast. And a lot of times it's a knock at the athletes who kind of pop in and pop out, and guys like me, because now they have to work. they have to have their potential listeners who have a decision to make when they're commuting home from their job at 5 o'clock, 5:30, saying, okay, do I turn into the Talking Mets podcast? Do I turn into this player's podcast? Baseball is boring, whatever. Whatever podcast you're consuming. Or do I listen to Michael Kay? Or do I listen to Frank Isola? Do I listen to whoever's on WFAN at that time? And now there is a true decision because people are saying, hey, I like what this person has to offer, even though it's not their full-time job, even though they're a freelancer, even though they're not a name per se. It's no different than, do I want to shop at Walmart? Do I want to shop at Target? Or do I want to go to the local boutique store in my neighborhood who offers some really cool things? And, you know, maybe it's just doing this, it's their job, it's a business, but it might not be the only way they make income. They're not a multinational corporation. And they give you a good experience because now it's about the experience. It's the experience that that person on the other end provides you, regardless of what the call letters are behind. And that's a hard thing for a generation of people who went to school, worked really hard, put a lot of time in, a lot of sweat equity. It's really hard for them to see a guy like me come in on once a week, twice a week, do some premium content, and quite honestly, do it while I'm doing 50,000 other things and trying to make a living just like you. And that's not me bragging. That's just laying out what the situation is, what the world is. So how do you go about getting above the fray? Well, you have this job that puts you with the players from February till October and all the travel and all the downtime. You're going to make relationships. You're going to make connections. And you're going to hear tons of gossip. And let's face it, gossip sells. One of the most interesting Mets books of all time is The Worst Team Money Could Buy. Maybe I'm dating myself with that. I think that that term is very overused since that book. Great book by Harper and Clappish. Even though it's dated, I suggest that if you haven't read it, read it. It'll give you a kind of a good insight into clubhouse dysfunction and what really is clubhouse dysfunction, because what we're talking about this weekend with Soto and Lindor and McNeil is not. And that sells. Gossip sells. There's a whole reason why TMZ is a business model. We as a society love gossip. We like the curtain being pulled away. We don't really know who Francisco Lindor is as a person. We don't know who Jeff McNeil is. We don't know who Juan Soto is. And although even a Pete Alonso who's very much preening for the cameras, we really don't know who he is. Everybody, to a certain degree, is wearing a costume when they're in front of a camera, when they're at their place of work. That's everybody. That's us included when we're at our place of business. And let's remind ourselves that a baseball clubhouse is a place of business. It's grown men playing a child's game for a lot of money, billions of dollars at stake, and it's still a workplace. It's an office. Just doesn't have cubicles. It has lockers. And they make a lot more money than your average office worker. Let's put it that way. So going back to the business of media, how do you gain some attention when there is so much information out there and everybody's attention is being swayed away? Well, you throw some gossip on a dead holiday weekend. And it is post-Thanksgiving, Friday, Saturday, usually pretty dead. People are out shopping, putting up their holiday decorations, maybe wrapping up their yard work with leaves and putting stuff away. It's your last chance, really, to potentially get some fall weather before it's going to get cold. It's going to snow here in New York this week. Winter's coming early, so you're trying to run around, and it's maybe you're traveling, maybe you went away. So how do you get attention? You do it by putting out some gossip on the front page of the New York Post. And you rehash an old story that I think MLB.com wrote about at the end of the year. It was more in terms of how Soto and Lindor are different guys and how they coexist, where Soto's a quiet, businesslike, man of faith, whereas Lindor, more progressive guy politically, into fashion, still into his job, and still very much a baseball gym rat, cage rat, whatever you want to call it, but has varied interest and is more vociferous. I mean, one of the things that has always been described to me about Lindor on the field, he's very talkative out there at shortstop, as well he should be playing a premium position. And let's remember, Lindor, before Soto walked in the door, he was the big contract guy. He was the guy that won the lottery with all these guys with that $350 million deal. When they traded for him and then they signed him to that deal just a couple of months after they dealt him, they essentially handed the keys of this team to Lindor. He didn't grow up with the team. He has no connection with the team before then. He had not even played a regular season game with the team. We talked about this for a couple of years while he struggled, about how Lindor and the Mets basically got married over a cup of coffee. And it was some tough times. And then, of course, 2024 happened, and away you go. And then Soto comes in, maybe the ultimate mercenary, who put up these all-time numbers, top five, top seven, top 10, whoever wanted to look at it, all time in the history of the game, putting himself amongst Aaron and Judge and Mays and Mantle. He and Judge were every bit Maris and Mantle, maybe better than the 61 version of those two guys when they played for the Yankees and they went and won a pennant in 2023. So where you're at now is that you have this potential combustible, or from the surface, the media would love to see another Thurman and Reggie, A-Rod and Jeter type of situation. So you go out there, you take a story that's been reported, you rehash it about how, you know, Soto, Lindor, different people, and they're not really tight. And you find out a story that probably was leaked from one of the coaches that were let go. Everybody assumes it's Nimmo. You don't know that. About some kind of argument that Lindor and McNeil had. I mean, you had a whole staff of coaches let go. Chavez has been talkative. Gibbons was on the Terry Collins podcast. You have no idea what the other guys are talking about. All it takes is one phone call. And if they're out of the game, they don't care anymore. They say, hey, I'll tell you what some of the things are going on in that clubhouse. And you look, there's nothing wrong with what Puma did. He just put out information. And the headline, of course, the front page, that's the icing on the cake. And here you are on a sleepy Saturday morning, riling up a fan base that, quite honestly, is easy to rile up. Because although I think 2024 really broke the yoke from that clubhouse, where I think the organization under Cohen is starting to move away from the failures of yesterday and the missteps of yesterday and the cloud that hung over this organization, pretty much, I would say it really amplified when they blew that 2006 Summer of Love season. I'm not so sure the fans are ready to let it go. And the media knows this because, remember, the media compartmentalizes stories because they have to go to these stories when news dries up, because their job is to generate eyeballs and just reporting what the story is, whether that be politics, whether that be sports. Doing nuts and bolts reporting on a topic is boring. That's basically going to school and sitting through history class. That's TMZ sells. TMZ is exciting. TMZ is storytelling lionized. Why get the real story about history when you could get a reproduced Netflix drama about it, which is thrown a little off? Bob Dylan movie, perfect example recently. I love the movie. I thought it was a great job, the movie. I thought everything about the movie, but there was some things taken for granted in the storyline. I'm not going to get into that, but anybody who's into the Dylan movie knows what I'm talking about. Not that it was made up, it was lionized a little bit. So why not do this with a story on a holiday weekend when we're all digesting from our turkey and maybe watching football, and baseball's just not something that's going to be foremost in the mind, maybe for us here at the Talking Mets podcast, for those that listen, but not for these guys. Now, does any of this matter that McNeil and Lindor had a fight? No. Does it mean that Lindor's a bad leader? I'm not so sure. As a matter of fact, calling out players when they either put in the wrong effort or don't miss their assignment or not focused or plugged into the game, that to me could be considered leadership. It definitely is leadership. We don't have any context to this conversation. McNeil, is he a clubhouse cancer because he throws his bat and he's grumpy when he's in a slump, and for some reason he's been in the crosshairs of Lindor because of some kind of defensive mishaps? No. I think there's a ton of value. He's got a reasonable contract. He's versatile. He's got a decent bat. I wouldn't just jettison McNeil, especially and I've talked about this before. Stearns has talked about having conversations with McNeil. Are they listening on deals? Sure. They probably want to shed some payroll because they may want to reallocate those dollars to something else. That's just smart managing of the roster resources, but that doesn't mean he has to go. And then this whole idea that because Soto and Lindor are not hanging out, if anybody watched the movie 61 Asterisk, Billy Crystal with Marisa Mantle, and there's probably artistic license taken in that as well. But in that movie, you actually had Mantle and Maris laughing about how the media was creating this friction between the two. And they were actually, they talked during it and they were like, hey, we're supposed to be fighting, right? This has been going on, guys, since the beginning of time. This is old school journalism. This is the kind of stuff that always was part of the city sports reporting in the 80s. I mean, headlines, and George Steinbrenner made a whole career off of it. It wasn't until G. Michael came in and said, hey, we're going to try start focusing on baseball, where they actually won. This stuff doesn't ever lead to winning. This stuff only leads to money for the media and for clicks. And quite honestly, I think the media really knows, and Puma is very, he's been around this club a long time. He knows you guys. He knows how you are as a fan base, and he likes to poke you bear. I've watched him tweet. I've watched him in action. And Mike's been on the show. This is nothing I wouldn't say to him to his face. I'm not, he has a job to do. Do I think that's how I would have handled the story? I would have taken a different tact. I think the MLB.com article, which talked about, and it was well done, which talked about the differences between two different personalities, is the way to describe it. There's nothing wrong with it. And for those who think that this is a big deal, I don't know what your jobs are, whether you're on a job site, you may be a contractor, entrepreneur, maybe you work in an office, whatever you do, you have to interact, I would think, unless you completely work by yourself, with the same people 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, minus whatever time you're away. And you could have the best office work culture out there. And I promise you, because I live it with the businesses I'm involved with, you ain't going to get along all the time. People are going to annoy you. There are some people in my life that on the business side that do tremendous things for me, that are loyal, hard workers, efficient workers, do great work. They are people that I'd put in the trenches every day, twice on Sunday. But if I told you that they don't annoy and grate on me sometimes, and there are things about them that I don't like, then I'm lying. If I'm going to tell you that I don't annoy people, just this show, I could tell you, with the amount of time, and I'm not talking to you every day, I know people listen to me religiously, and they'll email me saying, you pissing me off, Mike. That's what happens. We don't all have to get along. And remember the biggest thing here, when it comes to Clubhouse, when it comes to chemistry, it's not about going out. It's not about a song. It's not about grimace. It's not about holding hands. Winning is when players come together, and particularly in baseball, which is an individualistic sport, they know their role, they put the work in, they put the proper focus in, and they come to the ball yard ready to compete and win within a baseball scope. Now, with the 80s Mets, you heard all of that. Is it applied today? The drugs, the alcohol, the partying, that gets in the way of preparation. That gets in the way of coming to the ball yard and being ready to win. But not being into Francisco Lindor because you don't like his politics, you don't like his, you know, the fact that he's into fashion and you're not, the fact that you don't want to hang out with him. Look, if I was on a baseball team, I probably wouldn't go clubbing and hanging out with some of these guys either. They're just different. You know, some of these guys are going to go out to a Spanish club. Some of these guys are going to go partying somewhere. Some of these guys like to stay in. I think now the players don't party as much. Is it great to see teams go out? I remember a couple of years back, Tom Thibodeau brought his team together and the Knicks had this real synergy. I think in the NBA and on the court, that's a little bit different because basketball is about a symphony versus baseball, which is individualistic. But yeah, but that doesn't mean you love these guys all the time. You Mets fans, you want to go back a little bit to 1999, a team that achieved a lot of, nearly went to the World Series. That was a pretty dysfunctional clubhouse. I mean, Bobby Valentine talked about he had four or five losers in that clubhouse in September in the midst of a pennant race. And earlier that summer, if I'm not mistaken, Ray Ordonez got a black eye, and I think it might have been Louis Lopez that gave it to him. Now, again, I'm going back, but not everybody loves everybody. Everybody remembers David Wright throwing Noah Syndergaard's sandwich in the garbage, trying to teach the kid a lesson. That doesn't mean they didn't get along. It was a snapshot in time. So don't let this whole story start to take you in another. And I've seen some fans, and I think it's a very loud minority of fans that are talking about, you got to trade Lindor. Soto's not a fit. Oh, Soto wants to. I mean, the Yankee fans again. We're here. He's been a Met over a year. He's going into year two of being a Met. They're still sitting around talking about how he would have been better off with Aaron Judge. I mean, talk about a fan base that's the ultimate jealous ex-girlfriend. I mean, really. They love looking at the Facebook page instead of just moving on and finding their own mate. Really. So, I don't think I know the answers of what really is going on from this story. But I'm telling you this. I know McNeil's an intense guy. I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think Lindor calling players out and he being in the fray means he lacks leadership. Actually, I think the opposite. He may be showing leadership. Now, if he's playing politics, that's a different story. And if Soto is going to be the kind of player throughout his decade-plus contract with the Mets that just focuses on baseball and being the best offensive run creator he can be, and if that means he's going to start stealing bases because he wants to be a 40-40 guy and he wants to rack up the most numbers to be a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer, well, guess what? That's going to be good for the Mets because in baseball, being selfish and being individualistic is a good thing. And if he's focused on baseball, that's even better. Think about it. Here's a guy that got a big contract. He never has to worry about money ever again. He could take a vacation and be Anthony Rendon for the Mets. But he went out and he nearly became a 40-40 guy. He improved his game. He was in the top three for MVP. And he was taking on the biggest North American contract in history in New York, spurned a popular team with 27 world championships to go to the Mets. He took on a lot. And look at the season he had. So I lived through 1992-93. I lived with many of my teams that I root for over the years having locker room problems. I mean, heck, you listen to Derek Harper, Knicks fans who remember the Knicks from the 90s. He talked about how Oakley and Ewing, and if you read some of the Knicks books that have come out about the 90s Knicks the last couple of years, Charles Oakley's book is very critical of Patrick Ewing. Now, is that why they lost and didn't win a championship in 1994? No, it was Hakeem Olajuwon beat them. They could have held hands and sung Kumbaya all you want. I watched that series. I could replay big moments of that series to this day. To this day, 40 years later, right? 30 years later, whatever, 40 years later. And 30 years later. And I could see it in front of me. So I guess what I'm saying is, don't make this out to be more than it is. It's going to be a non-story by tomorrow. Mets will make a move probably in the next week. That'll be the story. The real conversation is how Marcus Semien and how impressive he was in his introductory press conference and how he's going to fit in. What does this move open the Mets up to? What kind of pitching are they going to import? What's going to happen? I think this is going to be a fascinating week for Mets fans because you're really going to see the 2026 Mets take shape. And if you start to look at the free agent market a year from now, forget about the lockout or strike or whatever is coming. I know Skubal will be a free agent and Peralta will be a free agent. There'll be some arms on the market. But from a positional player perspective, there's not a lot. You have some top prospects, the Mets. They have 8 out of 100 top prospects on some lists. A.J. Ewing. You have Benj. We know about the pitchers. Mets have a lot of things to be excited about and a team that is evolving before our eyes. And that's what you should be talking about, not whether or not Lindor and Soto are going to church together, or they're going to some parish fashion runway, or whether or not Jeff McNeil is sulking over an 0-4. None of that matters. If any of that led to them not preparing for their game or not being focused or not trying to improve on their craft or any of the things that relate to being the best version of themselves within the role they play on a baseball field, then yes, then it's a big deal. But I don't see that as being anything more than a nice TMZ headline grabber that generated conversation. Good job, Mike Puma. Good job, New York Post. You turned a sleepy Saturday during the Thanksgiving holiday weekend into a baseball conversation and had me go on for nearly 30 minutes in my opening. So you helped me a lot today too, because before, around this time last week, before the Nimmo trade hit, I wasn't so sure how easy it was going to be to create content this week and have conversations about the Mets, because it was almost, okay, this is going to be the calm before the storm. Well, guess what? The storm happened while we were on the air last week. It continued into Thanksgiving, and then it happened after Thanksgiving. So thank you very much, New York Post and Mike Puma. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Kodai Senga doesn't want to leave. Are the Mets getting Framber Valdez? What is going on with the pitching staff? I'll give you some of my thoughts right after this. All right, we're back. So Framber Valdez, Hector Gomez, who's, what is his son, I think? Gilbert Gomez is a Mets coach. Let me make sure I said this right. Gilbert Gomez, Mets. Yeah, Gilbert Gomez, coach for the Mets, reports that the Mets are close to a 6 or 7 year deal for $200 million with Framber Valdez. Kodai Senga comes out and says he wants to stay a Met, even though he has, I think, a limited no-trade clause now. And any kind of no-trade clause he has is going to make it difficult to trade him when he's on a down year. And let's also face it, I think Kodai Senga is only making $15 million a year. That's very reasonable by today's standards for pitchers. And I'll start there because at $15 million a year, and as angry as I've been at Senga, and I think the biggest thing I have about Senga, and he's going to have to overcome, if it's true, and again, we're going with reporting from a respected reporter in Andy Martino, if he decided that he couldn't pitch that final weekend in Miami because of mechanics, and he basically didn't pitch at all in September, and it wasn't because of health, it was because of mechanics, part of me just thinks, how do you get back into that clubhouse and face your teammates after you really let them down? Out of all the things that happened that have leaked out, we talk about Soto and Lindor and McNeil and all this nonsense that we've been talking about to open the show. The real damning story that leaked out, and it was thrown on in Michael Kay's show a week or so ago by Martino, just snuck it in there, not even talked about, was how Senga was healthy down the stretch, but opted out of pitching because his mechanics were off. And I think if you remember, there was a comment made that his throwing session went so-so because it was hot in Miami. And I was like, well, if he's not going to be able to pitch when it's hot, then all hope is lost because a majority of the game is in the summer. Yeah, I get it. It's humid in Miami. Sure, I get it. To me, that's the biggest gossip clubhouse problem I've heard out of all the stuff that's come out. Now, when I start to look at the rotation here, the first things first, I wouldn't just give away Kodai Senga. I know there'll be a demand from out there. It'll probably be 50 cents on the dollar. Any team acquiring him knows that the fan base is angry with him. A change of scenery is an easy sell because he's now had 2 years of disappointment, hardly pitched in 24, started out, even when he was good, I think he was deceptively not so good, still walked a lot of batters, his velocity's down. I think there was a lot of signs early on, even when he was pitching well, and he had an ERA of 1. And he has great stuff, and I've talked about it. Great stuff. That ghost fork is elite. I've seen it. Like I said, I was lucky enough to sit behind the plate and watch one of his starts against the Pirates earlier in the year. And it's great. It's elite. When he gets ahead and he throws strikes, that pitch is the dominant pitch that will make him a winner in this league. But if you don't throw strikes, and if your velocity's down and you're much more hittable, you never get to really use it. So I always think that he was off even when he was good. Other teams know it. They're going to try to do a 50 cents on the dollar with the Mets. $15 million a year is a steal for a pitcher that, honestly, as much as we want to criticize him, is potentially a top-of-the-rotation type, mid-rotation type when he's on. So you're not just going to give him away. And to me, that's why it's probably not likely unless they get something of value or they're dumping the salary and it's leading to another big move where he probably will still be around. I'm not so sure. Even after the bombshell that came down during our show last week, that Jeff Passan, who, give him credit, here I am saying, hey, he's got all these guys that are being talked about. Nimmo was one of them. I don't think any of these guys are likely to be traded. And then the trade happens in the middle of the show. So take what I say with a grain of salt. But still, when you start to look at the Mets farm system, when you hear about Benj, and now A.J. Ewing's name is getting thrown up there, a potential center field replacement for Tyrone Taylor. It seems likely that Cody Bellinger is going to go back to the Yankees. There was some smoke about that. Who the hell knows how a Kyle Schwarber will fit, especially if he's looking for a big contract, when he clogs up the DH spot. I don't know if the Mets are ready to give Kyle Tucker a big deal. Alex Bregman is interesting, but Stearns has already gone on record saying third base is Beatty's. So I'm not so sure that the Mets are going to make a big move in the sense where one of those big guys will be coming back their way. If they do go after a Framber Valdez, by the way, if you look at SpotTrack, $33 million a year is the AAV that he's worth. I know it's hard when you start to look at some of these guys' numbers, but a guy who pitches 180 to 200 innings, gives you double-digit wins, and goes deep into ball games in 2025 is an elite starting pitcher. You may not like it, but he is. And he'll get that from somebody. Maybe not the Astros. And I'll even tell you one further. And I'll bring him up over here on Fangraphs. Fangraphs had his last season. Let me tell you what it was worth. He was worth $32 million what he produced last year. Actually, the last 3 years, since 2022, he's worth, his pitching was worth $35 million, $35 million, $29 million, $32 million. You don't think, I mean, this is publicly available data on Fangraphs. You don't think that they have data, his agents? And what did he produce? 17 wins, 12 wins, 15 wins, 13 wins. Elite ground ball rate. Does he concern me? He's lefty. His best pitch is his most hittable pitch. Pitches to a lot of contact. If you look at his FIP, you're looking at a guy with a 3.50 ERA. Maybe, if you depending on some advanced analytics, closer to 4. But this rotation desperately needs innings. It needs someone to stabilize it and anchor it. And in a lot of ways, you saw the value of that kind of pitcher. Think about how Chris Bassitt played that role in 2022, and the Mets need that. So if he does get a 6 or 7 year deal at $30 million plus, Dylan Cease just got a 7 year deal. That was the guy I said, okay, that's the name, that's the player that maybe needs to rebuild his marketplace like Blake Snell did a couple of years ago, and nobody's going to want to go long-term. Well, Toronto decided to go long-term. And what that Blake Dylan Cease contract told me is that all it takes is one team. So as much as I have a high level of confidence that Alonso and Diaz are going to come back, because I think the Mets are going to find a way, there's this part of me in the back of my head that still says, look at how Toronto went out and just probably blew the Dylan Cease market away. Is somebody willing to do that for Edwin Diaz? Now, the flip side is Ryan Helsley just signed a 2-year deal with an opt-out with St. Louis for $28 million. And the Raziel Iglesias types, maybe that's the market for these guys. And teams are going to start to look at their budget and say, do I really want to spend $20-plus million on a closer for the next 5 years? Especially considering that who knows what years 4 and 5 of that deal look like, when I could just play this over a 2-3 year span. Closers are kind of like how the running backs in football used to be. They have a short shelf life. You don't know what you're going to get, even though Diaz has been good for a while and is so much better than the rest. So I don't think that'll happen with Diaz. But Alonso, you keep hearing a lot of smoke around the Red Sox. And, I mean, look, I know the wife is from Boston, Fenway Park, history. Pete could put himself in the middle of the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry. And, you know, if they go 7 years and $200 million with him, I think then the Mets have to look at it and say, what are we going to do here? And it's a tough call. And it is in the back of my head. And that's where I think the next 7 days, as we head into the winter meetings, where it's going to get interesting. Because nobody saw, I didn't see the Nimmo trade. And look, let's face it, if Nimmo didn't approve that trade, and I think Texas is one of the few teams he would approve to, and the Mets had to get something back of value or at least shed the money in totality. In this case, they were able to get something of value back that they needed, up the middle defense, and somebody who potentially, if he comes back healthy, and that broken leg, I don't think that that's something that should be taken lightly. And this Liz Frank injury, I think you really need to realize it's a serious injury. And then the fact that they shut him down, it was smart. He's got a jump start on it. But the Mets got something back. So already they've kind of fooled us a little bit. And I don't think we could predict anything. Because like I said, all it takes is someone to do to Pete that they did to Dylan Cease or to Diaz. And this whole offseason gets turned upside down. And it'll be a fascinating winter meetings, and I think a lot of the Mets' big heavy lifting potentially will happen in the next 2 weeks. I don't know if we're going to see players. Not there will be players, but I don't think you're going to see like what he had Santander and Alonso bleeding into late January, February. I don't think players are going to want that. I think you're going to see the big names, the Diazes, the Alonzos, the Kyle Tuckers, Schwarber, Bellinger. I think they got homes the next 2 weeks. I'm not saying it'll happen this week. I think you'll start to hear some more rumors and some more things come out, probably from the agent community to gain leverage. Listen to who says what. If it's a Boris client and Heyman says it, take it seriously. This Bellinger stuff about the Yankees gaining steam on Bellinger is unsighted in internet rumors. I don't want to hear about incarcerated Bob. I've been down. I know nothing against Bob, but really, I can't. I can't go back to the days where incarcerated Bob is breaking rumors. And he has. I know he's got somehow with the gambling community. I can't. I can't do it. And we saw that last year with the whole Red Sox and Soto and all that. You got to stop with this stuff. There's only a few people that really have a feel of it. Rosenthal, Passan, Martino, Heyman. That's really it. You know, Sherman in there too. You know, throw maybe, you know, I know Bill Madden throws stuff out there. I mean, Bill sometimes has, he doesn't really do this at the same level. He's not full-time anymore, but he's not plugged in like that anymore. So, it just buckle up. But I'll tell you this, if you think that the contract for Valdez is crazy, you're not paying attention to where the market's going. That's why trading Kodai Senga is a complicated conversation. Look, would I like to see the guy on the next train out of here? I can't stand the guy. Nothing personal. He has been completely disappointing. He's let this team down. Maybe I called him gutless, and I think maybe I went over the top in this summer, but I had every right to be angry. And let me tell you, when you heard, and maybe you didn't hear it live, but I told you, I heard it with my own ears. He was on the Michael Kay show. Martino said it to Kay. He did not pitch down the stretch because his mechanics weren't right. To me, that's unconscionable. It reminds me of the story, and I'm going back to my Pat Riley 90s Knicks days. And it was in the book by Chris Herron, Blood on the Horns, right? Was it Blood on the Horns or Blood of the Garden? I'm sorry. I'm looking actually at the poster here. Blood Garden, the flagrant history of the New York. Blood Garden, that's what it was. Blood on the Horns, that was a Bulls book. And they were having a pregame meeting, and Riley looked at Charles Smith, who was in a suit, and said, "Hey, man, like, if I needed 2 minutes from you today to win a ball game, could you do it?" And he said, yeah, sure. And he says, "Well, why are you there in the suit?" And he obviously used more colorful language than that. And I kind of thought of that when I heard the Senga report from Martino. Like, you can't give the Mets a couple innings with your mechanics. You can't figure out your mechanics to throw some strikes to the Miami Marlins, a team that sticks their rear ends out. And if they don't find a BABIP hole, they ain't hitting any, scoring any runs. Really? I mean, really? Like, that's what I thought, and I think that's a hard thing to come back from, but I also know the business side of baseball, and I know that pitching is going to cost them a lot. Do I think that they're going to see if there's a market for Peterson and for, because they trade, if you remember, they traded Steven Matz going into his last year, and for Senga, sure. I'd like to see them potentially bring back Griffin Canning and maybe do a rehab contract. I mean, Clay Holmes is going to be back. You have the young pitchers. They're going to get somebody via trade or by a free agent signing. I think that the Japanese, the Far East market is still out there. Imai is out there. I mean, we'll see what that goes on with that. I think it's really hard to predict. And at this point, I'm going to stand by what I really want to see from David Stearns. I'm not going to give you names again, because who the hell knows where this is going. I think that they should investigate if a Scooble or one of those guys is available. They're probably not. It doesn't sound like a Contra is available. So that doorway's closed. The next step is they got to bring in somebody who could eat innings. Framil Valdez fits that mold. He could eat innings and he could pitch at a top of the rotation level. I think they have to scour some of the potential next big arms that need to leave their organizations, whether that be a George Kirby or a Mitch Keller or Joe Ryan. I've named some names. Find a way to see maybe if you can acquire those guys. And with your pitching lab, bring them to the next level. do what the Astros did with Cole many, many years ago. What they did with Verlander. I mean, is there a veteran that could get a late career renaissance under the Mets pitching lab by bringing them in like Verlander had coming from Detroit to Houston? The Mets will tout this pitching lab and Yeager's and Driveline or whatever's going on in there. Well, got a new pitching coach. They're all deep data-driven. The smartest guys in the room, let's see you do what the Astros did all those years ago. Now, I know what people are going to say, the Pelican grip dip and all that stuff. I get it. There was a lot of funny business going on in Houston that nobody talked about, but they still were able to get these guys to improve their stuff. And then as far as the hitting, as far as the bullpen situation, I think it's Diaz or bust. I think the bullpen will be very interesting without Diaz. I think the plan is to have Diaz and then find good arms that they can work with. I don't think they're going to go out and sign another big-name closer. They might be opportunistic. I don't think they're going to do a Helsley Diaz Pardue. I don't see that. I think they're going to go out and find arms, either on the scrap heap or maybe trade for an arm that's in an organization that they think that they could do something with. Maybe they bring back a Tyler Rogers or a veteran, but they're going to wait till that market comes back to them. They're not going to lead the market on that. And if Diaz is gone, well, then it'll be interesting how they pivot on that with Suarez, with Iglesias, guys like that. Because, you know, to me, the options of post-Diaz make me nervous, to be honest on that. And then offensively, look, they now have, they need bats. They improve their defense. The bat is in question in Semien. They just lost a really productive left-handed bat in their lineup. How are they going to account for that? And again, I'm not so sure that a Cody Bellinger market is coming to them. A Kyle Tucker market is in their appetite. A Kyle Schwarber. So is it a deal? Is there a big bat? I know sometimes people speculate about Fernando Tatis Jr. That would be interesting. But again, I don't want to rip apart this farm system. I still think, listening to Stearns, that they're going to give their young players more rope and chance to be part of this thing next year than you guys really honestly believe. And I know that's going to make you uncomfortable, but I seriously believe that's going to be part of it. You have Lindor, you have Soto. Bringing Pete back, I think, potentially will make that more of a reality. Now, if Pete walks, then it'll be interesting how they address that. Maybe then you got to take Kyle Schwarber and that bat in the short term more seriously while you figure things out. You need to replace the power. Although I still don't think Schwarber, even with the bombs that he hits, is the RBI guy. And I think he's much more pitchable too in a big spot than Pete. To be frank, forget about the off the field and the fan Q rating and all that stuff. So I do know one thing. I think it's going to be a very interesting couple of weeks. So buckle up. And the good news is we're going to be spending time and living it together. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When I come back, mailbag. Let me get to some stuff that I missed last week. I know I got some commentary about Lindor. We'll talk about that more as we wrap up right after this. All right, we're back. Final thoughts, Talking Mets podcast, get to mailbag. Want to read some of your comments. There was a couple from, I think, last week that I didn't get to because it was around this time last week as I was doing the mailbag and we were talking about sports gambling where the big trade news came down. Now, I hung around and did the show a little later today because I was like, watch, I do a show and then Framber Valdez signs or the Mets make a deal or something, but it's late Sunday now, and if something comes down after I get off the air, oh well, we'll just have to pivot and do what we got to do. So, all right, let's start. Lindor and the captain conversation and Soto and McNeil, that's on your mind. So our friend Sam, he wrote yesterday, and I thought it was a good commentary, and I addressed a lot of it in the opening, but let's start with that comment. So Sam wrote to me, and his title of his comment was Fake Captain. Notice how with every locker room story, Lindor is in the middle of it. It just isn't a coincidence at this point. I have a feeling you'll poo-poo this, but it's not good that teammates keep having fights like this. They need to mature fast. We now have a better understanding of why Soto wants Marte as captain. Soto even unfollowed Lindor on Instagram. He used to follow him. Lindor has campaigned to be captain, but hasn't gotten it yet. Locker room has been off since 2021. Too much drama makes me tired of it. Always leaking a problem. Constant leaks. Every time a player or coach leaves, there's more leakage. Dave Island leaked the Brody chair story in 2019. Chili Davis leaked things when he got let go in 2021. In 2023, we got Tommy Pham complaints and Puma peace on the group not being close before the deadline. In 2025, presumably Nimmo is now leaking just a couple of days after. If there's one thing Simeon can help solve, it's fixing the culture. We need a healthy workplace. I don't care that guys fought in the 80s. I don't see the correlation. Completely different world. In 2025, you have to get along more, especially when the player who's always in beef is the one who wants to be captain. The coaching staff could also do a better job straightening things out. It's long overdue for them to get this fixed. So I think Sam tackles a lot of different things in his piece and his comments, and he's not wrong. I mean, I don't necessarily agree that 2025, you need to be more cohesive than in 1980 and the fights and everything. I think that the world has changed a little bit where the culture frowns on violence and frowns on some of these things because it's more of a corporate environment than it was in the 80s, where it still was men playing a kid's game, where I think now it's become more corporate, less ball players in front offices, and even ball players that are old school ball players. There's no Earl Weavers, Billy Martins managing anymore. I mean, heck, you've got college coaches coming in. And as far as the leaking, it does seem, and he's right, that when people are let go from the Mets organization, they leak. Now, I'm not so sure it's Nimmo. It could be some more coaches, and maybe it's the way coaches feel on the way out. Now, think about this. The guys that are coaches that were fired, and I don't remember if it was really Island that leaked. I think it might have been, and I think Chili Davis had some comments on the way out. It's been so long. I mean, the last 4 years has gone by in a blur. But look at the profile of the coaches that have been let go. Chavez, Island, Chili Davis. These are guys, Gibbons, old school guys, grew up in a different ball game, being replaced, and we're seeing it at laser-like speed this offseason, that the game is now getting more technical, more younger. There is the Giants hired a college coach to be their manager. You're seeing more young, whether they're from Driveline or from college campuses, or just guys who more minor leaguers that studied the game on a more technical route, they're replacing the old guard fast and furious. There's not going to be a Chili Davis in the league as a hitting coach anymore. There's not going to be a Dave Island as a pitching coach anymore. As far as veterans, look at what Ottavino said a week ago. We talked about that on his show, on his podcast. Tommy Pham on the way out with a very intense guy, really good grinded out veteran. These are veterans that I think are having trouble with the changing of the game. And this has gone on for years. In the 90s, the old players from the 60s and 70s complained about the guys of the 90s. The guys of the 90s complain about the guys today. I think that that's a culture thing that we've handed down from generation to generation. Every generation thinks they have it easy. Every generation prior thinks the next generation has it easier. I heard it a lot growing up. Now people who are my age are complaining about the younger people today. I don't think we're all wrong. I don't think we're all right. So I think you have to look at the kind of people that are leaking. I think they're disenchanted with the way that the sport is going. And that might lead to them not throwing out fake information, but making more out of some stuff on the way out because they're angry. Because they're basically being pushed out of a sport that they grew up and were successful at and were considered. I mean, at one point, Island was one of the top pitching coaches in baseball. And Chili Davis was one of the better hitting coaches in baseball. And Eric Chavez was considered a really good hire when Billy Epler hired him because the Yankees thought very highly of him. They talk about him in Martino's book about the Yankees. So I'll talk about that. As far as Marte being the captain, and I mean, Soto likes Marte, probably the older player. And I think he's one of these veterans that's a glue guy. You always need a glue guy in the locker room that is able to bring people together and make them feel comfortable. Yes, I said during the opening, it's about going in and doing the job and being the best version of yourself within the baseball context. But you want to feel comfortable in your workplace, and that goes into feeling being part of the group. And it sounds like Marte was a guy that was able to do that. Let's also remember, for Soto personally, I talked about this in the open, Soto took on a tremendous amount of bullseye on him when he signed that contract and left the Yankees. Now he was the highest paid player in North American sports history. He goes from one franchise to the other, and he was expected by Mets fans, who are not easy on free agents and certainly not easy on guys that come over from the Yankees, to be the man from day one. And even when he struggled, he was still good. It was a very, out of all the transitions to New York, it made Beltran and Piazza's transition, it was nowhere near that. It was nowhere near that at all. And we made it so much out to be more than it is. And by the end of the year, his numbers were as good, if not better, than they've been historically. Add in the stolen bases, and you have yourself a tremendous season at this point. So I think Marte was one of those guys that personally for Soto was helpful. I don't think you could bring Marte back just for that. That's a coach's job. Maybe you bring in a guy like that to be kind of like that vibe coach. I know that in the modern game, coaches are expected to be technical and handling all different video and analytics and being really up to date on giving the players information. I think one of the things that worries me about the modern game is that there's so much information that sometimes now your mind gets cluttered, and what really matters? Because you even see it when you look at a player. You go to the Baseball Savant page. You could look at a player and break down all these different things. And sometimes I just say, okay, what exactly do I look at on this page that helps me really understand the player? And I think the players have to, and I think that's what they're hoping from these coaching changes, what can they do to break it down? Because there's just so much. And as a player, you never turn the switch off. In the old days, it was, you know, go to the ball yard, play a game, talk about the game, and live the game in the hotel bar after bonding over brewskis. And sure, there was the work and infield and things like that, but there was a lot of passing down through lore, through conversation, through, you know, following a veteran, how Keith talks about Lou Brock all the time on the broadcast, how Keith Hernandez, when he came with the Cardinals, there was Lou Brock, and how David Wright talked about Joe McEwing and Cliff Floyd and guys like that. Like, that was baseball. I think now the focus is so much more on mechanics and pitch shaping and all these resources because we have them now. The things that, they always existed. They always existed. It's just now they've given technical terms and they have graphs and video and probably more information than you need. So, and then the last thing here about Lindor as a captaincy, I would say, Sam, if he's calling players out and holding players accountable, that is captain-esque. Now, I don't know what generation you're from, Sam. You mentioned that it's not like the old days. Maybe you're a younger guy than me. Maybe you're older than me. But I think that in my world, in my growing up, calling people out publicly and holding people accountable, that was a good thing about leadership. Now, there's a right way and a wrong way to do that. And I think that being vocal and making sure that everybody's pulling in the same direction, and if you're not happy about something, you speak your mind. For an intense guy like McNeil, that could really piss him off because he probably knows that what he did is wrong. See, McNeil comes across as a guy to me that he knows he screwed up. He's pissed about it. He's angry at himself. And then the fuse that blows is when somebody, while he's angry at himself, piles on because now it's himself and the other player against him. And I could see that. I could see where that fuse would be. And we don't know what Lindor's communication style is down on the field or in the locker room. We don't know. We just see the smiley guy in front of the camera. So I think that the thing is the Mets have just had more people leak. Look, Clint Frazier was leaking about the Yankees this year about how horrible they are with young players. It's not just the Mets. I think sometimes we think it's just the Mets. We just focus on the Mets. So I think you have some good points here. What I'm saying is I'm not poo-pooing this, Sam. I just don't think this is as big of a deal, and I think that this is a Thanksgiving leftover that has a 24-hour shelf life. I think by tomorrow it'll be done. And by the time then the news comes down that the Mets signed somebody or that somebody they were interested in signed somewhere else, it'll be long, long, long forgotten. So, you know, we'll leave it at that. Jason, wanted to talk about the trade. I think Mr. Stearns was as motivated as he was to move Nimmo because he can't hit high velocity anymore. He was a minus 7 runs in value against fastballs in 2025 per Savant. The last time he had a negative value against fastballs was 2016, his rookie year. Defense getting worse. His swing decisions weren't as good as it's been. These last 2 years were tough watching him. He's on the downslope. I wish him well. A great, nice man, though. I didn't care for him running to first base a bit. That got corny. Didn't really bother me. I think, Jason, we see a lot of that. I think I was very impressed with Simeon during the press conference. Comes across as an intense guy. He's a guy that I didn't know that really turned himself into a gold glove second baseman. Ron Washington, who I don't think is a great manager, but is a very highly respected infield coach. And he's actually in Moneyball. If you watch Moneyball, he was the guy that was working with Scott Hattieburg at first base when they were turning him to a first baseman. So he's known to be able to get the best out of players. So it's a good baseball tree that Simeon learned from. Can he bring that intensity and work ethic to the young players in particular? I think he could have an impact on a Beatty, an Alvarez, a Mauricio, an Acuna. By the way, Luis Angel Acuna is having an incredibly good winter ball. Does that mean that he's an option to be traded and maybe bring some more value back? We'll see. The Mets have some young talent. They have a lot of young talent. And I think that we have to understand that they're going to not trade all these guys for a solution this winter because they won 83 ball games last year. So we'll see that. What else do we have there? From John, some notes on the director of hitting. Simeon met with the media and mentioned Jeff Albert a few times. I know he was the director of hitting, but I didn't know how much about him. I did a deeper dive. I don't know if you're on Instagram, but his account is at Hitting Research. He's also on YouTube. He owns and runs his own private hitting company on the side. Watching these videos, the amount of in-depth detail he goes into is fascinating and impressive. Website is hittingresearch.com for his written articles on hitting, and generally seems to put a lot of hard work into this. Some very unique thoughts on different things in hitting. He feels different than your ordinary hitting coach when you watch his videos and read some of his articles. Not to throw shade, but it's hard to imagine Eric Chavez getting into this level of analysis on hitting techniques. I guess we'll see. But I'm impressed. Maybe we'll see internal improvement with him in charge. I thought I'd share this because you mentioned you do a deeper dive on Justin Willard. Yes, I did listen to Justin Willard on Baseball's Boring. Baseball is Not Boring. I shouldn't say Baseball is Not Boring podcast. I'll get into that. Again, I'm behind because of the Nimmo trade. John, I will say this. What I have been, and Albert's been in the organization. I haven't really paid much attention to him because he's been working with the kids. And to his credit, when guys like Beatty and Alvarez went down, they got better. Now, it was the big league part and the question, are they 4A, which I brought up. But I think on one of those Fangraphs articles, and I think you have to be a Fangraphs member to actually read it, he mentions the old Ted Williams article, and well, not article, video. And I think back in 1986 or 87, Williams actually sat down with Wade Boggs and Don Mattingly, and like those are the two best hitters of that at that time, and talked hitting. And what was it? The Science of Hitting. That's his book, The Science of Hitting, Ted Williams. And if you go to The Science of Hitting and Ted Williams, a lot of what is talked about today, even from a pitching standpoint, has been talked about over the years. I think where Jeff Albert and coaches like that are going to help is they're really going to take the storiness of everything or the way that everybody communicates the concepts, which sometimes some are better communicators than others, and they're going to try to turn it into some kind of infrastructure. And I think also Albert is trying to take that science of hitting and break it down where the principles that make a good hitter. Now, you're not going to turn a Punch and Judy hitter, or even like a Jeff McNeil, he's never going to hit 40 home runs. But you can even see a Jeff McNeil, they've made some changes to his swing. Whereas he was a guy that would just dink and dunk for the most part. And he would definitely punish a baseball in the right spot. But he was more like going the other way. Like a lot like Pete Rose, I would say. Early in his career. He doesn't do that anymore. I think they're trying to basically mechanize hitters to be a certain way. Now, is that going to work? I think it's going to mean that you're going to have to a certain type of body type. You're going to have to a certain type of hitter. I don't believe everybody should be a carbon clone of each other. But I do think that what I could see from Albert is that he's trying to take hitting and he's trying to create a real database of information that makes it more digestible. Now, whether or not he could communicate to the players that way, and is Troy Snicker going to be a big asset in that and help? We'll see. What I will say is we're seeing a wave of coaching changes in the sport. It's a new era. The old guard is getting pushed out, and this is going to be their baby. Now, is this the way to go, and will it swing back? I don't know, but it's over. The days of the drinking buddy getting a pitching coach job or a bench coach job, you need to be very versed and a subject matter expert on something to keep a coaching job, and it is a long day. It is a lot of prep. Think about how these NFL coaches sleep in their office to a certain degree. I think that that's where some of these guys are going to be at. These are cage rats and or, you know, field rats if they're a pitching coach, mound rats, whatever you want to call them. So I think that we're seeing a revolution of sorts, and it'll be interesting to see what comes of it. So good resource. I do agree. And John, we'll look more into the coaches throughout the winter when things die down a little bit. I think Willard, our new pitching coach, is somebody that we definitely we want to get, you know, more information on. Now, let me go that over here. There was another really good comment here. Oh, our friend Frank. Frank wrote last week, and this is in the midst of all the chaos of the Nimmo trade. You have to trade one or two of Vientos, Beatty, Mauricio to get the starting pitcher that you want, or a good quality center fielder, or a closer if Diaz leaves, or a first baseman if Pete leaves, assuming you don't fill those holes via free agency. Who are you trading, and why are you keeping whom you're keeping? So I thought this was a great comment or question by Frank. And I'll throw in Acuna. I'll throw in Alvarez into the mix, too. So I've talked about this. I think out of all the players that you mentioned, Beatty and Alvarez have the most upside. And Beatty, yes, was a first-round pick, but I think Beatty from a build, power, defense, the fact that he's able to even show some versatility the last couple of years, everybody's talked about his makeup and mindset, coach's son. Alvarez is a unicorn in terms of the kind of power he has. He's got a great work ethic. I think it's more about him being smarter, and can Alvarez hone his emotions to channel some of that effort and energy and the things that he's good at to become more of a complete player? Because it's not just about talent in this sport. It's between the ears. Mauricio, Vientos, and Acuna, to me, are a little bit more expendable. Vientos, because what he's good at is a one-dimensional thing. Now, it's a valuable thing, power, but power is not as uncommon in the sport as it used to be 10 years ago. And to me, I'm not so sure Vientos will ever hit good pitching consistently. I think he's a streak hitter. He's certainly, his value is on offense, and Stearns has said that. No matter how much he works at the corners on defense, he'll never be a net positive there. And to me, he's a DH, and a DH who hits 30 home runs, 25 home runs, hits 250, 260, streaky, probably profiles in a good lineup as a sixth or seventh hitter. Those are expendable players. I don't think he's going to be the next Pete Alonso. Let's put it that way. I think what we thought Pete's floor would be when he came up is what Vientos is as a player. Now, Acuna hitting great in winter ball, haven't seen the stick at the big league level, had a really good introduction week in 24 when nobody knew who he was, at the pitchers were throwing fastballs. He certainly has some pop, and he can run, and his glove is elite. But to me, a backup infielder, a glove infielder that could play multiple positions has value, no doubt, but he's certainly expendable at that point. And Mauricio, that guy, I will tell you, and the metrics bear it out, he might have as good of a glove, it's particularly a third, than Acuna. He might be a gold glover there. I just don't know if he understands how to take all that immense talent and learn how to hit, recognize pitches, adapt and adjust as the league changes to him. I think he's a toolsy guy that's always going to tease because of the tools, is always going to have a high regard in an organization for now because of the tools, but I don't see him as somebody that'll put it together. Now, I don't know anything about him. I'm not saying he's not working. To me, I just saw a guy that, and maybe that part of that is the ACL injury, and he's behind in development, and he was left on the bench because they wanted to keep an option for him next year. And maybe that's where you potentially see him go to AAA and tear it up and maybe become a solution, maybe become a piece that they could trade for something. But I you may regret Mauricio. Mauricio's the kind of guy out of the three I mentioned that you might regret because he might go up and be Alfonso Soriano with somebody else. And you're like, damn. But I could see him being as much bust than as boom. I wouldn't give him away, but if he needs to be part of a deal to bring in those pieces that you talk about, and I'm talking about really significant upgrade pieces, not just a veteran that you're going to take in on a deadline deal or on a one-year flyer, then no, I wouldn't just give him away, but because you don't have to. You still have control over him. That's how I feel. So I thought that was a great comment, Frank, and we've talked about it. Beatty and Alvarez are the two gems out of that group. Now, the next wave, Morabito, who's more of a component player, A.J. Ewing, Carson Benj, Elian Pena, even Chris Suero, who had a big Arizona Fall League. There are others I'm sure I'm missing. We're not sure yet. I do know the Mets system is now ESPN, not exactly a Mets love fest over there, has them ranked in the top five in the league. So, you know, to me, that says a lot. So, and I'm sure I missed some people, but that's all I got for today. I'm running out of steam here because it's getting late here on a Sunday, and I think the turkey leftovers are kicking in a little bit. So, anyway, so what's next? We have the winter meetings at this time next week, kicking off next week. I know there's going to be a bunch of stuff over at Beyond the Mic, and if you haven't subscribed, please do. And if you're listening and you want to get a free trial, and I'm throwing this in there, so this will be a test to see who actually listens. I got some free trials for the holidays. I gave a special gift on Friday to everybody as a thank you, putting out there free for all listeners that article about Simeon, my breakdown on Marcus Simeon. So go check it out. TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can go and click the link. It brings you to the premium content over at the Substack. But if you contact me over at Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com and say I'd like a free trial, I have about 5 coupons left from the holidays for the first 5 people that contact me. So Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'll get you signed up. You'll get an email from me personally. Then you'll get an email from the Substack service on how to sign up. And we'll get you the free trial. And if you like it, you can stay on. I mean, there's deals all the time. This is the most affordable, great content. What it does is it covers some overhead here, guys. That's all. I wouldn't charge you anything if the overhead was free for me. I really wouldn't. I love doing this and interacting with you guys. So what are we going to do? There's a lot to talk about. Obviously, the Mets are going to hopefully make some moves. I definitely think we're going to do a Twitter Spaces. So follow me on X if you're not at Talking Mets Podcast. At Talking Mets No G. Excuse me, I'm getting everything mixed up here. I'm going to be talking about the contemporary baseball ballot. There's going to be it's a very interesting group of players. There's a couple of Hall of Famers on there for sure. I see 3, maybe 4 Hall of Famers. It'd be interesting how the Veterans Committee votes on some 90s players that certainly deserve to be in. Are they going to get over the steroids? What's going to happen? It'll be very, very interesting. And then, of course, there's the New York factor with Don Mattingly. So that's going to be a story. I think that's going to be a conversation. We always like to talk Hall of Fame here. We'll do the Twitter Spaces. I don't know what day. I'm thinking because the news breaks quick, we'll do something. We'll set up the whole winter meetings thing. Maybe I'll have a show a little earlier on Sunday. And then we'll do a Spaces at night. Maybe we'll kick off instead of doing a show as Spaces. So I'm not so sure how this is going to work because the problem with this show during the winter meetings is news comes fast. So we might have to be more reactionary. So the Sunday setup may not work. So just stay tuned. I'll be on X talking about it. I'll send an update over on Substack about it. And if you're not on either one of those, you want to send me an email and say, hey, Mike, what's going on? I'll answer you over email too. So, you know, we'll take it from there. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And you can get me over at the new and improved, exciting website, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Come join the chat. That's free. Sign up for premium content. Interact with me. You can get updates on the show and listen to the show as well. All in one place, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Winter meetings time. Until then, take care, everybody.